Our meeting is called order. Welcome to any business, Mr. Chuck, you have a present, Mark?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed with the Secretary of State as part of the Chapter 551 Government Code referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I would like for this fact to be noted in the official record of the meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chuck, and one other important announcement I have today before we get started with the Finance Committee. Everybody's staring at their new laptops, I guess. It'll either go a lot faster or a lot slower. I think an important announcement. I'm really happy to announce this. I've asked Commissioner Friedkin to take over as chairman of the Regulations Committee. And in keeping with the succession, I think it's a good idea to take advantage of Dan's unique experience and insight into hunting and fishing. And good luck, I can tell you. It's an interesting and challenging area. I've enjoyed it, and I know you're going to have the support of all your fellow commissioners. And keep regulations as shorter than finance. Is that possible? And with that, we'll turn over to Ned Holmes as chair of finance.
Thank you. First item is approval of the previous meeting minutes.
So moved.
All right. Second discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. First item is land and water plant update. Mr. Cook.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The first item that you touched on is continued funding here. And as all of you are definitely comfortable with this tonight, but just in case, I have Ryan and Ernie already sitting right here, readily available for me, and I'll either loan them to you, or you need to just wave your hand down in case you do something like I would do to kind of X out of the screen or whatever it is. So we would appreciate your feedback on this system. Obviously, the next call is good to get totally into it, but I believe that the folks have worked up the best system for you, and one that will save a few little trees and build continued by yourself. Another item that I wanted to tell you about, yesterday we met with the state, with representatives from the state auditor's office. As I had mentioned to you earlier, they're beginning an audit on our state park system in November to determine whether current budget projections and deferred maintenance costs for parks are reasonable and supported. They will also review how we allocate resources in the state park budgeting process, and we talked about that some yesterday in another discussion. You know, centered around will be the allocate based on number of visitors or what, you know. So we had a brief discussion about that yesterday. They review to determine if we have a systematic process of review to manage our inventory of state parks for decision making. And they're starting immediately. We're setting up a couple of three office spaces for them out here. We expect a team of 5 to 7 auditors to be in place almost daily here, and we'll be doing some work through state parks, through various parks around to show them exactly what we're talking about in some cases. They told us yesterday that they anticipate having a final report done on this in February of 2007, and that will be one of the miracles of time if we get that accomplished. Our internal audit shop, and you may recall also Dennis O'Neill recently issued a report on our state parks revenue system. The state auditors plan to coordinate that work with theirs to avoid duplication and a lot of effort. And so we're working very closely with them on that particular issue. Thank
you. Any questions for Mr. Cook? Next item is the legislative preview and update. Mary Fields.
Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, I'm Mary Fields, Chief Financial Officer, and I'm here to present a legislative preview and update for the 80th Texas Legislature. I'll start off with just an update of where we are in the appropriations process. As you'll recall from the last commission meeting, I briefed the commission on our LAR that was submitted August 18th. On September 11th, in a joint budget hearing that is called by the governor's office and the Legislative Budget Board, or the LBB, we briefed staff from both of those offices, along with staff from the Lieutenant Governor and Speaker's offices. At that hearing, we presented a high-level overview of the LAR. We reviewed our exceptional items and responded to just a couple of questions from staff. On September 26th, we invited legislators and their staff to the Capitol to attend a legislative awareness meeting. There were about 30 people in attendance at that meeting, and Walt Dabney presented his presentation on state parks, and Mr. Cook went over our exceptional items. And that meeting, I think, went fairly well. On October 9th, we briefed members of the Senate Finance Committee. The committee holds this hearing before this session basically to get a jump start on understanding issues for the various state agencies. Chairman Fitzsimmons provided opening comments, and Mr. Cook reviewed our LAR and exceptional items at that hearing. Commissioner Parker was also in attendance, and he responded to some questions. The members did have several questions at that hearing, primarily related to health and safety issues at state parks, and there were also questions about the cost increases at the East Texas Fish Hatchery. So that kind of gives you an overview of that hearing. We'll continue to brief legislators in the interim, as we have been. Right now, several are focused on the election, so we'll pick back up basically mid-November and carry on through. The session starts, as you know, on January 9th, and in late January or early February, the General Government Subcommittee of House Appropriations will have their hearing, and there will be another hearing for the Senate Finance Committee. I think it's probably the best thing to do is just at the next commission meeting tell you where we're at with those hearings, and we'll carry on through the appropriations process just to keep you informed on what's going on. I'd also like to give you an update on where we are in the process for developing other legislation that's important to our agency. From September through November, staff has been developing legislative issues, and there are numerous issues that have been identified. From the time frame from November through January, we'll select some of those key issues, develop the legislation, and identify sponsors. As you can see on the various dates up there, November 13th is the first date to file bills. I think most of our bills will be filed probably at the beginning of the session, which, as I mentioned, is on the 9th. We do have 60 days to file bills, so the deadline for filing will be March the 9th. The last day of the session is the 28th of May, and finally on June 17th, that's the last day for the governor basically to sign or veto the bill. So that's kind of the process. Some of the issues that we're looking at, we wanted to limit them to roughly 5 or 6 key issues that will move into legislation that will develop. We do have some license issues, and as Dr. McKinney has discussed in prior meetings, we'd like to simplify some of our licenses. And there may be some statutory changes required for that simplification that we need to address. And the department is also monitoring and actively working with federal fisheries agencies right now to implement aspects of the currently proposed federal reauthorization of the Magnuson-Stevenson Fisheries Management Act. Basically, the feds are wanting to capture information on recreational anglers that are landing fish which have caught in federal waters, and they are considering a federal license, among other things. What we're looking at is seeking authority to extend our state saltwater fishing license to cover fish that are landed in federal waters so that there would only be one license that would be needed. That's in the event this legislation was passed. And Dr. McKinney is here. If there are any further questions on that, that's about the best I can do on that, those subject matters. There are also several county-related housekeeping issues that we'd like to address in statute. Most of those relate to where certain funds are deposited, in what funds, A good example is our license plate revenue. Right now, all of those plate revenues are deposited in Fund 504, our capital account. And we like to go ahead and have the Blue Bonnet plate revenue go into the State Parks Fund 64 account and the Horned Toad Bass and Deer plate revenue go into Fund 9 against Fish and Water Safety. So there are just some cleanup items like that that we'd like to address in the bill. Most of those are county-related. Law enforcement is proposing to amend Chapter 31 of the Water Safety Act along with the penal code, and this deals with driving a vehicle while intoxicated with a child passenger that's younger than 15 years of age. And basically, we want to include the operation of a motorboat on that. And finally, there's several issues that are just need some fine-tuning. There's a list from law enforcement, a list from wildlife, legal proposed issues. So we'll be looking at those house cleaning items and may have a consolidated bill on that. And that concludes.
I guess I'd just like to add that I think Mary pointed out there that, you know, of course, we'll be clearing all anything we're going to go forward with the chairman and the leadership. But, you know, just about everything that I've seen so far coming up from South is pretty much clean up, clarification, you know, get it in the right spot, take that away, we forgot that last time, that kind of thing. And my primary thought process there are what we're thinking there, and we don't really want to do anything with no big problems. We don't want to do anything to detract from our primary purpose in this session.
I would just ask a question about the federal fishing license. Or is this something they're seriously entertaining? I guess they are. Obviously, we're going to be talking about it.
Commissioner, for the record, I'm Larry McKinney, Director of Coastal Fisheries. Yes, they are. They're looking at several options in the Max and Stevens Act of trying to collect this information. And what I'm concerned about is that it will... It has come up reauthorization this year. It will come up in the next couple of years. And in all the scenarios that they offer up as far as how to get this information, a state license that extends into federal waters will substitute for that federal license. So my big deal is I don't want our engineers to have to buy two licenses. They'll be covered. And the problem, of course, is that we have to have legislative authorization. We only meet every 2 years, so we need to have that authority so that we can add.
Okay.
In time, so we don't get caught in that last minute. But if it doesn't happen, if they don't make that requirement, we won't go forward necessarily, but we want to have that authority to respond.
So then we need to request the authority in this
session in order to be ready
to have it on the shelf.
To have it ready to go.
Okay, would an analogy be how we work with migratory and non-migratory? I mean, and if you got 9 miles, you just had your Texas license. If you're beyond 9 miles, you'll have to have some sort of federal stamp or something.
9.5 pounds, I think, will be covered. And in fact, I don't think the practical implications are much of anything. I don't have the data, but anecdotally, I think just about anybody that fishes off the Texas coast, federal or state, they've got a state license. So the number of people that don't have a state license already is just not my answer.
Okay.
If I understood it correctly, Larry, amplify this. Currently, commercial fishermen are fishing.
Recreational.
Under current regulations, if the commercial fishermen in federal waters have to have a Texas state license to land their fish, and recreational fishermen do not.
That's correct. Yes.
And so this would basically equalize.
Right. And make sure that they do. And it helps law enforcement as well, obviously, because no matter at that point, no matter where your fish came from, you need that special license to have it come ashore.
And what it really does is it allows a mechanism to gather data more than anything.
That's really what they want. I understand, and I appreciate the fact that they're going to start collecting recreational data for a chance.
Do you foresee a charge for this?
If it's a separate federal, yes.
But if we did our own,
we want to extend our authority.
Okay.
That's one of the reasons I don't want to do it. I don't want an additional charge.
Yeah, that's what I'd worry about, too.
And that data is the basis for our share of federal money.
All kinds of things. I know, mm-hmm. Of course, we're talking to law enforcement. The fact that we spend so much time on the recreational side of it, and they clearly don't get the apportionment of money is necessary. It's based on commercial right now. We need that recreational in there because we're so highly recreational in the state. Mm-hmm.
Dan, you see how everything becomes regulations? No matter what you
say, one way or another, it comes around.
Thinking about that.
Any other questions for Mary?
I just want to say that having been there at the Finance Committee, we were, I think, very well received. The members of the committee had obviously read not only Baylor, but the Montfort Commission report, and they're serious about addressing our needs for some stakeholders. So that was my impression. Tough questions, but serious to the goal.
Mr. Chairman, also might be interested in the fact that since that hearing, Senator Ogden, Chairman Ogden, had visited two or three of our state parks and had an extended visit, looking in the shop, looking in the bathroom, looking in the cabins, looking over the equipment, our impression is that he has been very impressed with the openness and honesty and the information provided.
I've had several follow-ups with senators, members of the committee since then, thanking us for doing the work we did with the Montfort Commission report, and I think everybody's pretty clear on that there's a need, and it has to be addressed.
We're seeing some feedback about somebody that talked about. There's some people saying that, you know, we got what we requested last time. Is that coming out of legislature, or is that just coming out of the general
public? We heard that back in the summer, a couple, three times, and we immediately put the numbers together and started showing those numbers around a little bit on a one-on-one basis, and we haven't heard it in the last 45 to 60 days.
Oh, good. Yeah.
That was a misunderstanding or whatever.
Thanks.
Employee performance evaluation system.
Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Al Bingham. I'm the Human Resources Division Director. And it's always my pleasure to give you some updates on our other critical medical resource. Over this past summer, the Human Resources Division staff undertook a project to redesign our performance management system. And today I want to brief you on some of the tweaks that have been made to the system that are going to be expected for this current evaluation period. I want to give you a little background about performance management here at Parks and Wildlife, also to include our business case for making some of the changes and what our new approach is going to be. Before we started making changes to the system, obviously we consulted with executive management, and it was important for us to get agency-wide input. So I want to talk briefly about that redesign process and then introduce you to the PPWD critical job competencies and some other significant changes to the system. When we talk performance management, what we're really talking about are those actions, management actions taken to ensure employees perform in a manner that ensures successful organizational outcomes. We are required as a provision in the Wildlife Code that the agency will provide for a system of annual performance evaluation. This next slide provides an overview of our performance management model. Pretty standard model, five phases. Draw your attention to that center circle job description. All our jobs in the agency exist in support of higher level organizational goals. As I said, five phase process. Performance planning begins in this phase. Our supervisors provide clarification on job duties that set expectations. The next phase is ongoing feedback. It continues throughout the evaluation period. We expect, again, that our supervisors and managers will provide appropriate feedback to their staff on how they're doing, recognize good performance, confront poor performance. Employee input, again, this occurs throughout the process. We want to know how employees feel, how they're doing from their perspective, what their successes are, what their barriers to success are. The evaluation, performance evaluation piece is where the supervisor formally assesses the employee's performance against the standards that were set during the planning phase. And then the performance review phase is just a formal sit-down where the supervisor or manager discuss the ratings with the employee. This whole process basically is just to facilitate communication between the supervisor and staff. The most important part of this whole thing is the ongoing feedback, again, it breaks down. When we get to the performance review stage, there should be no surprises. We always tell our supervisors and employees there should be no surprises at this point. When we look at the system and specifically the evaluation phase, our business needs were for a more uniform evaluation system. As you know, we have 11 functional divisions, and when we look at it, you know, it seemed that each one of those divisions were evaluating employees on something different. So we want more uniformity or standardization. We also want there to be more focus on those performance behaviors that truly have the greatest impact on overall organizational success. We want the system to be in tune with the culture, the strategic direction, and where possible, we always want to simplify the process. So we thought our solution was to move from the task-based performance model that we were using for our employees or basically evaluated on the functional tasks associated with their job and incorporate a competency model approach where employees are evaluated on common behaviors that we believe lead to improved overall performance. So what is a competency? When you talk about competency or being competent, that means different things to different folks. From our perspective, when we talk competency, what we're looking at are those specific behaviors, skills, knowledge, or mindset that are causally related to superior performance in a job situation and result in successful outcomes. Competencies may be gained in a variety of ways, whether it's life experience, formal education, on-the-job experience, or formal training and education. So as part of this redesign process, we look to identify a discrete set of competencies, 5, 10, 15 so, that are specific to Parkland Law Life, unique to our culture and values, and that could be applied across all agency positions. So what did we do? When we were considering the changes, there were two important factors to consider. Number one, we wanted agency-wide input on any proposed changes. And two, we wanted the changes to be supported by good business practices. We conducted a series of one-on-one interviews with the assistance of an outside consulting firm with Mr. Cook and the other executives. We had a series of focus meetings with our line managers and staff, both in the headquarters and out in the field. We had an agency-wide survey. We sent out an email survey to over 2,300 employees, and we had an amazing response rate, 54% response rate. And in this whole series, what we asked questions, what you like about the existing system, what would you change? But the key question that we asked was, you know, when you think about your outstanding performers, what do they do different than the average performers? What do they do different? So as we did that, certain things began to bubble up in all the groups that we surveyed. We also benchmarked comparable agencies due to our outside consulting firm. We got information about best practices of both public and private sector organizations. And at the end of the day, we ended up with 10 job competencies that were identified as being critical to both individual success and the overall agency success. The 6 competencies listed here, mission focus, integrity, service focus, effective communication, teamwork, and continuous learning, these are considered the core competencies. And these competencies are applicable to all agency positions, regardless of level in the organization. So whether you're a game warden or a staff accountant or budget analyst or wildlife biologist, all these core competencies applied to those positions, and all employees will be evaluated on these core competencies. Each of these competencies have been defined, and we've also put a great amount of work into establishing what we call behavioral indicators or anchors that describe the various levels of performance. The second set here identified is the leadership competencies. The leadership competencies are applicable to our managers, supervisors, and team leaders. Again, setting direction, ensuring accountability, coaching and feedback, and making optimized decisions. So our leadership will be evaluated on both the core competencies as well as these leadership competencies. We feel that this approach offers several important benefits to the agency. The most important benefit I see is that it provides a way for us to establish some uniformity in the system, some standardization, if you will. Again, all employees will be evaluated on the core competencies, and then all leaders, managers, supervisors, and team leaders will be evaluated on the core and the leadership competencies. Some other changes that have been made in the system. Of course, the incorporation of the competencies was the most significant change, but there are a couple other changes I just want to touch on. Beginning this cycle, all employee performance plans are to be linked to specific agency, division, or program goals. Our premise here is that, again, all agency positions exist in support of higher level department goals. Again, whether it's the land and water plan goal or the goals that established in the national agenda. And we think that employee performance is enhanced when they know how their efforts contribute to the overall success of the agency. So again, on the plan as well as on the evaluation, we're expecting our supervisors and managers to identify those goals that have position support. Just another quick change. We separate forms for the performance planning and performance evaluation. In our existing system, we had a single form that was supposed to cover both. That caused more problems than it was worth. So, again, separate forms for performance planning and performance evaluation. These changes that I've described will be effective this evaluation period, the FY07 evaluation period. At this time, many supervisors are completing their 06 evaluations in our existing system. We are scheduling trips around the state to orient our managers and employees on the new system and the incorporation of the competency with the idea that plans will be in place by January 1st, incorporating the new competency. Again, they will be evaluated next cycle. And with that, I'm available to answer any questions.
Good question for Alan. I'm glad you added that last piece about going around the state and teaching everybody how to work this plan. It sounds like a great plan, but proof will be in how it's actually implemented in the field.
But you involve quite a few people.
Yes, sir.
As you put the plan together.
Yes, sir. Okay. It was important for us to say, well, this is not just an HR plan, something that
comes down from the office. Yeah. Exactly.
We even involved Dr. McKinney.
He didn't want to be involved, but he's involved.
Sometimes we leave him out.
Yeah, it does look good.
Anything more to talk to today?
Thank you, Alan.
Nonprofit partner rules and price.
Good morning. I'm my name is Wright, General Counsel, and I'm here to talk about our nonprofit partners. The Parks and Wildlife Code authorizes the agency to select and cooperate with nonprofit partners and authorizes the commission to designate an official nonprofit partner. I think you all know this, the foundation, the Parks and Wildlife Foundation. Parks and Wildlife also requires the commission to adopt rules about best practices for these nonprofit partners, standards and safeguards for accounting for assets held by a nonprofit partner, and I should point out that we don't do that. But if we did, and our rules that I'm going to go over in a minute basically say that's not going to happen. and guidelines for the official nonprofit partners, solicitation, and acceptance of sponsorship. There's also a provision in the government code that would apply to us that also requires that the agency adopt rules about the relationship between the agency and donor organizations or donors. And I think you all know that nonprofit partners really do provide a vital service for our agency. The draft rules, in trying to organize these, we basically separated our nonprofit partners into three types. One is the official nonprofit partner, the foundation. The others are closely related nonprofit partners, and those are our friends groups. These are organizations that exist to support a specific facility or a program. And then there are general nonprofit partners. It's my understanding that during the sunset process, one of the desires that was expressed by the legislature was that we have a comprehensive list of all nonprofit partners that we cooperate with in any way. So that would include someone that we have, or an organization that we have an agreement with, or an organization that provides a representative to an advisory committee. And as we go through these, in coming up with these rules, the restrictions or the requirements are going to be more restrictive for the official nonprofit partner and the closely related nonprofit partners because they're actually representing the agency in many ways. The general nonprofit partners, those kinds of requirements are pretty much just things that they would have to do anyway, things like they have to be incorporated, that sort of thing. Because we're required to adopt that best practices and to try to organize these, we divided them into several categories. General best practices, and those are just simple things like they have to be properly incorporated, and then for the official nonprofit partner and the closely related nonprofit partners, things like they need to file certain financial statements and certain documents with the agency. Best practices regarding officers and directors. One of the things in the Parks and Wildlife Code is that all officers and directors, at least all organizations, have to have access to or be provided with our land and water plan, which is a thing that we want to make sure happens. And then we also have some requirements about dealings between officers and directors in the organization. And a lot of these are again, just sort of general best practices in terms of managing a nonprofit. We also are recommending some best practices regarding fundraising and sponsorship, and those are very closely tied. And our main focus there is to make sure that if an entity is raising funds on behalf of the agency, that they're coordinating with the agency. And if there's some sponsorship recognition, that we know about it and are agreeable to it. Then there's some other things, and these are really just sort of the cleanup items, the criteria and general requirements and the department procedures, for example. Pointing out that all donations over $500 have to be approved by the commission. To also point out that we're going to be continuing to work with our closely related nonprofit partners and the official nonprofit partners on these rules before we send them to the Texas Register if we're given authorization to publish these. We've got probably a month or so, and we want to make sure that the requirements that we're imposing, that there's nothing we're missing. And one of the things, for example, in your package, it talks about transactions between officers and directors and the organization. We don't want to, the document in your package actually says that there should be no transactions, and actually we don't want to prohibit that. If an officer or director wants to make a large donation, we want to make sure that that's not prohibited. So there are things like that we're going to continue to tweak these. And then staff is recommending that these be published in the Texas Register for public comment when we come back to you in January. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for it's not an authorized staff publishing time in the Texas Register to be required public comment period. Item number five, Ode to Artwork.
Good morning. My name is Frances Stiles. I'm with the Administrative Resources Division. We're here today to present the artwork for this next year's print program and stamp, collector stamp position. Under the terms of the contract with Collectors Covey, the commission reviews the artwork each year. for approval. The collector's stamp to compose and then offer to the public for sale, and Parks and Wildlife does receive a portion of the print sale back as revenue.
Where do I find it? Is it on the screen somewhere? Just look up here.
The picture by the
board. Have to raise your head.
Under commission agenda item 50, you have to go back to the
You've got to go to Thursday agenda.
Now you can go back to the original page, home page, and go to item 2, agenda item 2.
Bob, those things we get are every commissioner. This one says 2.
That's what isn't that obvious? Isn't it obvious?
Sorry, it's obvious.
I hope the number next to it doesn't reflect the IQ.
Mine's number 10. I guess I'm the odd man out.
All right.
Sorry, it's obvious, I think.
All right, with me is Mr. Martin Wood from Collector's Cody for the Industry Hardware.
Gentlemen, let me go over the present art that we're presenting. The behind you on your right or left, the wood dust painting, of course, is the migratory bird stamp for 2000, proposed migratory bird stamp for 2007. It was done by Bruce Miller, who lived in Minnesota. Bruce won the federal duck stamp competition in 1993. It is the first time he's done anything for us in our duck stamp program. In keeping with, while we have not always used former federal duck stamp winners, that sure seems to be for the duck stamp for the migratory duck stamp. That sure seems to be the logical place to start, because all the dealers in the state are familiar with the name, and this is almost as much an autograph business as it is an art business. A mediocre David Moss painting would probably create more interest than a great painting by an unknown artist. I didn't make those rules, but that's one of the rules that the industry goes by. Anyway, that's the migratory bird stamp. The upland game bird stamp is obviously scale quail by Eldridge Hardy. Eldridge has done several stamps for us in the past. He did the 92 quail stamp print when it was a fundraising print for Quail Unlimited before that was set aside by the changing of the turkey stamp to the upland stamp. He also did the quail in 2002 under the same condition. In 89, he did the turkey stamp that later became the Texas turkey stamp print, and he also did the 2004 turkey stamp print, which was done for the department.
John, that is generally the position. We did that for you because that's generally the position that you shoot them in. And you appreciate a good standing shot.
You have a reputation, John. You're skilling shooter.
Every time I drag up my gun, he drags his own.
Oh, okay.
The saltwater stamp is by David Drinker. This is the second time that we've done a snook. I'll take it back. It's the first time that the department has done a snook. The second time the GCCA stamp and print was a snook many, many years ago when we were publishing that stamp. David Drinker is also very familiar with the Texas stamp print program. He did the 94 turkey stamp, the 95 quail, obviously before it was an upland stamp. He did the 96 non-game of cardinals. And he did the 98 saltwater of the trout. David lives in Beaumont. Over the years, we have received some criticism from local artists who inquire about doing a stamp print program, doing one of the stamp print programs for us. Invariably, those people that are calling with questions will say they've never entered a duck stamp contest. They just thought this would be a fun thing to do. You should only use Texas artists. Well, this program, for whatever condition it's in now in sales, it would be non-existent. No state has enough artists to sustain
an ongoing stamp fee program, and it has been proven by many states such as Louisiana and Minnesota to now sell less than 300 duck stamp grants, that's state duck stamp grants, because even Minnesota with all the artists up there, they have 10 artists for every one we have at the wildlife one, they just can't sustain the interest. But over the years, we have used, and I'm not current on it, but the statistics are we've used more Texas artists. More than half of the art that's been done for us has been done by Texas artists. The non-game is the Red-Tailed Hawk by Jim Haltman, who's also a Minnesota artist. Jim has won the federal duck stamp 3 times. He's done several duck stamp prints for us over the years and other stamp prints. He has won 3 federal duck stamp prints. That ought to be, that's enough. But he's also done at least 3 Texas waterfowl stamps for us, several non-game stamps, and he's probably the most famous of all of the duck stamp style artists in the country. He and his 3 brothers, all of whom have done things for us, have won the federal duck stamp print 7 times in the last 15 or 18 years. They just almost have a lot. In fact, his brother, Joe, plays 2nd this year. And the last one is by Mark Cizino, who is unquestionably the best freshwater fish painter in the country. He did our first freshwater stamp of the largemouth bass, and that, of course, is the smallmouth taking the fly. And I can tell you what he's done for us. But it's, here's Hartman. He's done the 93 Texas, the 97 Texas, the 98 Turkey, the 99 non-game, and the 2006 Upland game stamp of the quail last year. Cizino has done, got way too many papers here. This is impressive, I know. You did the 1994 saltwater stamp, the 2003 saltwater stamp, and the 2004 first freshwater stamp of the largemouth bass. And that's the lineup this year. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them. And,
I guess one question I just had, I noticed your income revenue is off 06 relative to 05.
Right, and it'll be off next year to pure fiscal. We look at that as 05,
right.
But your fiscal 06, and it'll be off next year. That's just the nature of these stamping programs. I want a nationwide, but ours falling left, and ours, the state of Texas is made. I mean, clearly, I don't have access to them, but twice as much money on their stamp print program as any other state, period. There's now 26 duck stamp prints. You would take a wall that big to display them all. There's still over 1,000 people that buy them. 98%, 99% of those are bought matching numbers. People buy their number every year. And obviously, there's some attrition, and there's just not a lot of hope, unfortunately, that someone's going to come along 26 years into the program, one, not know about it if they have an interest in things we love, and two, I'm going to start collecting this in the 27th year. That's good. Sometimes maybe a favorite species, or I hunt blue quail, I'm going to buy that because I'm a Midland blue quail guy. Occasionally you sell a few prints that way, but it's really not.
Primarily collectors.
Yeah, primary collectors, and you go, and the number is one of attrition. I might call y'all to attention a couple of things. It's only a side note, but this year for the first time, 2 of the artists that have done our print program died. Larry Hayden, he did the first duck stamp print, which at the time was the largest number. The first Texas duck stamp print was the largest number signed limited edition print ever published anywhere for any reason, bigger than any federal duck stamp print that was ever published. We paid the state $770,000 that year in royalties and stamp fees. That was more than the state made off of the sale of the stamps. I mean, it was just unheard of. And the first Texas duck stamp print spawned 25 other states doing the state duck stamp form. But they couldn't
they could fade the political heat of having more than just resident artists. And Louisiana, at the last minute, created political pressure from the legislature to do only Louisiana artists.
And, of course, it became a non-event in the second or third year. Yeah. But also, Stuart Gitlin passed away. Stuart and Scott Gitlin did the Golden Eyes about 3 years ago, and they paint together. And Stuart died suddenly of a heart attack and lived in Fort Worth. He was a great friend of Leah and Ramona and Catherine, and probably some of you all too. His brother Scott, who also did the Dutch Camp and signed the Dutch Camp with him, has done a two-portrait of George W. Bush. And these guys are big-time guys, and I think they did the Dutch Camp for Catherine, you know, because clearly there was nothing, they did not need this in their resume. They really, for the first time, we lost two of our artists, which is, I guess, probably surprising in 27 years that, you know, there hadn't been cracked before. Anyway, I wanted to make a note of that.
Yeah, what was that retail for? 145 dollars
plus the stamp.
That's the entire set.
No. Now you wonder why they fell for
it. I thought that sounded like a bargain.
I haven't heard that word used with the Dutch stamp for a long time. You guys get $28 a print. You all make more off of that print than we do. We would be the largest dealer, retail dealer in the federal Dutch, I mean in the state Dutch stamp print, whether we publish it or not, just because of the nature of our business and having been in the business so long. But I'm not in any way trying to imply that we're doing you guys a favor, but state of Texas is the best deal in the country on Dutch stamp print, I promise. You know, but with, you know, we're suffering from declining sales. You know, when you made the decision to automate your licensing program without physically requiring the stamp, the sales dropped 25% that year. People, well, they don't need this. This isn't a real stamp. And they're right. It's not a real stamp. This is a collector stamp. You know, we couched it as cleverly as we could. But, you know, the trade-off for automation was a 25%, you know, and I'm not remotely trying to say that that wasn't a good trade, but things like that, you know, impact the, you know, people are looking for an excuse to quit, and we're trying not to give them any more excuses than we can.
was that a good trade?
The automation.
Okay. I haven't seen the number that's related to the decline in revenue, but I would guess that would have been the decline. I mean, would there have been a decline in revenue from any other source other than this one?
Well, the Dutch stamp print would have been declining regardless.
Right.
But, you know, if you look over the records, a 25% drop is the world record. And, you know, and that was an absolute known factor when it happened. And so, how can we couch this to keep people's interest? And I frankly think we did a pretty good job. While it's not remotely, you know, I'm looking at these numbers. We did $970,000 the first year on Hayden royalties to the state. And this year we're doing $71,000. Well, clearly, it doesn't take much mathematician to figure that's a 90% drop in revenue. It's still $71,000. You know, we look at it every year from our perspective. Are we making money on this? And our answer is, yeah, and plus it's part of our identity. I mean, it's clearly part of our corporate identity to be able to do the Dutch stamp. I mean, we are awfully proud of having paid over $7 million to the state of Texas over the last 26 years, to say nothing of the matching funds you get from the federal government because of it.
Do you see a correlation in sales of a given stamp relative to the artist that signed it, or to your perception of quality?
You know, this shouldn't be a salesman's attitude, but the fact of the matter is, I don't think that we can do much to impact the upward sale of the stamp. But if you come up with mediocre, amateur, unknown art, you can kill the program, and if not 1 year, certainly 2 years. You know, you cannot give the collecting public an excuse to quit collecting. Hey, I got enough of these, you know? I mean, I don't need any more, you know? And
which means that the quality is just a little bit off if you decide if you're going to go with only local or whatever that is.
Oh, the quality then, wouldn't be a little bit off. It would be.
Then
you don't get to see on a daily basis what I get to look at.
I bet you could sell much of those good stuff.
Well, I hope so. It's certainly doing it. It's a species story. I'm nuts for pintails. I would be more drawn to a pintail than any other duck, but most people would be drawn to a wood duck. I think this is the third time that we've used the wood duck image in the program, and that's not accidental.
I was really referring to the, really the, what I perceive to be the quality of the
right, exactly.
I want to congratulate you on Elder Tardy.
Thank you, Nick.
I'm bought at because I own a few, but mm-hmm. he is top drawer, and that's
this is the second wildlife painting I ever bought. The first one was David Hagerbarmer. The second one was an Elder Tardy at the Spelt Belt in San Antonio in 1965. I'm sure I've been there for a speech. That's the second. I still have that painting. And if you know Elder, Elder is just an incredible guy.
Where is he from?
He's from Denver, Colorado.
Great gallery. Yeah.
Any idea that you can increase it? Is just no way? I mean, essentially, this is just...
If we could get a duck stamp to every caterpillar purchaser in the state of Texas, and every Toyota dealer purchaser in the state of Texas, how's that for an idea?
You know,
do what?
You left out every beer.
Yeah, every beer. All the others combined.
You never get a pack of beer. We have built a war room. I'm going to come out to the first and grab them and stick them in a six-pack. There's an idea.
Make it illegal not to have
one. Yeah, right.
Show me the duck beer.
Show me the duck beer. One criticism I have of the department. Of all the great things they do, they're not very good on a consistent basis of getting their story out of all the good things, I mean, and sometimes incredible things that they do. I mean, this duck stamp story is, I don't know if you all remember this, but when this duck stamp legislation was introduced in 1981, it was introduced by Ducks Unlimited under the table. And the way the legislation was written, John knows this, he's probably part of it, 50% of all the revenues were to go by legislative decree, go to Ducks Unlimited. To say nothing of the fact that they would have screwed up the print side of the equation, which the first year was a heck of a lot bigger than the stamp side of the equation, that it wouldn't have had any long-term value, you know, you wouldn't have had anyone on a long-term basis. Well, from that, with the help of Perry Bass and Jeb Wood, we turned it around to what it became, which is 100% of the revenue. You know, the idea of taxing Texans and sending the money to Canada, at that time, they had a policy of singleness of purpose, so Ducks Unlimited could not spend any conservation dollars in Texas, in the United States. It all had to go to Canada. That wasn't a hard sell to undo that deal, but the first time I heard about the legislation is appearing before the Senate Natural Resource Committee, or whatever they called it at the time, the next day, a great guy named John Wilson, who's now Facebook manager was carrying the legislation, but that's where this started from, and this is what it's become. And you know, believe me, however disappointed you all are, we're more disappointed in the sales. But history has shown that this is not unique to us.
Okay.
So please accept our mediocrity. You know,
we're not worse than anybody else, right?
Yeah, we're not any worse than anyone.
Yeah.
And we're not stealing any more than we have to, than we need. So. Well, I think as you get down, there's some people that just aren't going to quit it. You know, and I don't know where that number, I would like to think that number is at 1,000 in 16, but I have a feeling it's not. And I have a feeling next year we'll break 1,000 on the downside. But, I mean, clearly the people are becoming more and more hardcore. You know, don't want to admit they made a mistake and start buying anything. You know, if we'd have told them 26 years ago, hey, you're going to get 26 years plus to buy this thing, we probably wouldn't have sold 50 of this needle we're sticking in your arm. We're not going to pull out for 26 years.
I think, you know, something.
People don't need to know everything.
But we can't say that.
You don't think there's a market outside the collector arena? In other words, like at trade shows or something, you know?
I mean, there's a lot of people, in this business that are smarter than I am and work harder than I am, and they haven't found the answer either. So please, if we don't think of it, we can damn sure copy it real quick. And, you know, we're on a daily basis. We're in contact with dealers. And so this is a phenomenon that goes back to 1934, you know, in the federal duck camp when it first came out. And to think this is the longest and biggest collectible, I don't know these numbers, but this is part of our baloney, has ever been created. That people have been collecting these things for 75 years now. And it's really remarkable. You know, it's a testimony to, you know, people really feel like they're giving the conservation and they're doing, you know, somewhat doing their part in getting a neat image in the process. The prices are sort of institutionalized because all of these programs are done by, you know, with a contractor. And a lot of the states don't get any of the money from the print. Minnesota, it's artists. Gets all the money. The state doesn't get anything. They just get the images and stamps. And, which is just unbelievable, particularly as states like Texas and Arkansas came along and started really making significant money off of this collectible that they still let, they just don't want to mess with it. And of course, they suffer from a lack of continuity in the in the marketing of it. I can guarantee you we ain't going to have a wood duck for 4 or 5 more years. You know, I mean, if we have anything to say about it, we're going to try to run in a mallard, run in a green-winged deal, run in, you know, maybe a goose. But the artists don't care anything about the 1 year they're marketing it, and then they, you know, then the next guy doesn't care anything about what went on in the past, and they're just so, you know, as modest as our marketing effort may appear to you guys, it's a whole lot better than some of the alternatives.
John, did you ever put
Bubba, have you ever put out a catalog where people pick out ideas?
Oh, yeah, we've had loads of our dealers in Houston and had them come, you know, our biggest dealers, invite our 10 biggest dealers in Houston to come and let's talk about the duck stand and let's see what we can do. We have 4 or 5 really good duck stand dealers. And the rest of them just, hey, if people want them, we'll sell it to them. But we're not going to make any attempt to really get out and hustle these things. You know,
victim of modern depression.
Well, it's just a victim. Hey, the staff's not required. You know, it's interesting. Other states that have automated their licensing program still requires the stamp to be physically put on the license. And I promise you, there is. I mean, I can't tell you the complaints that we got from people in 1996, I guess it was 96, 97, that say, I like licking that stamp and putting it on my, I'm not necessarily print buyers, but they like the, you know, the fact that it's pretty, they, you know, it's just, it's part of getting ready for duck season, you know, it's part of the ritual, you know, it's checking the string on your decoy, putting new weights on them, and going down and getting your duck stamp and putting it on your license. And people really miss that ritual. But obviously the trade-off was, how else could we get Walmart employees to enter all the data in our database on our licenses so it would be 100% wrong rather than only 70% wrong?
I've got my family collection of the stamps back to 1934.
Yeah.
And I've maintained that. But, I just wish that we could come up with some idea for
regulation.
You know, the one thing I think that we haven't been very good at, and we certainly hadn't encouraged the department to do that, is you got these beautiful images. It's just crazy not to use them on promotional material, on presentation to the department, on the next flyer that's made or the next folder that's made. You know, why not?
Right there, that's an idea.
You know?
That's an idea. That's what I'm talking about.
We have at least four times produced, we produced a poster for the Duck Stand Sprint and would ship it to everyone who buys a, the last one we did, I guess, was Larry Hayden in 92 or 93. We had all the duck stamp images on the bottom and his current big image on the top, and anyone who bought a duck stamp, because we could ship it, and we just had to use a little bigger box. One of the things about giveaways to promote the sale of anything is it costs more to send it to them UPS than the giveaway cost. You know, the poster costs $2.50, but the shipping it individually would cost $6 or $7. And we shipped it with the print, you know, we shipped it to the dealer. And everyone loved getting it.
Let's see what our sales did in 1992 to 1993, just for the heck of it. Believe me,
In 1991, we sold 4,790 prints. Oh, try this on for size. It was 1991 that we did that. I'm not smart enough to confuse you guys. We had 4,790 prints. The next year that we did the poster, we had a drop off of 10%.
It didn't make any difference.
Of course, the thank you was after the fact, sort of. But it's really frustrating. You know, probably so frustrating that we're not trying as hard as we could try. I mean, you know, it's just, hey, we've kissed a bunch of frogs and they all say frogs. You know, we can't get one to turn into a print.
Any further questions for Bob?
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
No further questions. I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Mr. Cook, any further, Adam?